Greetings, Linux and free software lovers. I'm Cristobal Palmer, Vice Chair of the Triangle Linux Users Group, Trilug. Find out how to join, sponsor, or otherwise enjoy Linux at trilug.org. You're listening to audio of the November 2007 Trilug meeting, Thursday the 8th of November. Our speaker was Pat Patterson from Sun Microsystems, our generous sponsors this month. His talk was titled Identity from LDAP to SAML and Beyond. This audio podcast is available under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license, or at your option, the GNU Free Documentation license. It is also supported by Trilug and iBiblio.org. To reach us for more information, please visit trilug.org/contact and fill out the form.
What I'm going to talk about for a few minutes, so it's not too painful, is going to be our OpenSSO project and how that relates to Sun's products, and give you a bit of information about that. So my day job is I'm the community guy for OpenSSO. This is what I do, go and tell people about it. So OpenSSO, the SSO is single sign-on. So the idea here is that, and you'll hear a lot more about this in the main presentation, what single sign-on is and what it does and so on. But the idea is that you want to log in at one place and then access stuff at another place, and that's basically it. So Sun has had a product for a long time called Access Manager, and a couple of years ago we took the decision to turn Access Manager into an open source project. So we created the OpenSSO project, gradually moved the source code across into the open public CDS, and we're building the next version of Access Manager, which is actually going to be called Federated Access Manager 8, from OpenSSO. So if you've heard of GlassFish and Application Server, it's exactly the same relationship. So Federated Access Manager will be OpenSSO. Build that source code and you get those bits. So it's very, very simple. So right now, we're just doing the first QA builds of FAM 8 from the OpenSSO code base. And this has given people an opportunity to preview what's in the product. So the product won't be out for several months. You know, we've got QA and beta and all this stuff to do. But you can get it and play with it right now. I'm going to trip over these cables. So what is the OpenSSO project? Well, it's a project on dev.java.net, and we just recently passed 500 members. So you don't have to be a member to go and download the source code, download the bits, play around, but you do have to be a member to do things like file issues and obviously actually make contributions. So we actually passed 500 members. We've got about, of the order of about 10 external committers compared to about 40 internal Sun committers, so about 20% external folks submitting patches. And as far as java.net goes, we are always in the top 10. In fact, the other month we were number 3 behind GlassFish and Hudson. So this is a very high visibility, high traffic project for Sun. And so we actually, even though this code, I mean, essentially it's like a car in the garage with the hood up and bits of engine going on the workbench and so on. We've got production deployments using it already. One of the very first was in the UK, where a system integrator called Good Technology deployed it at Audi cars. So in Audi UK, you go to their customer website, and you log in to get your brochures or whatnot, and that's what you use. You use OpenSSO, and the system integrator loved it. I mean, he said that he was going to do something custom, but he took the OpenSSO framework and was able to extend it and point it at the existing user tables that they had in a relational database, and he just got it working. It was amazing. I mean, the small number of questions that actually came back to the aliases was just incredible. OpenID.sun.com is Sun's OpenID experiment, giving OpenID services to Sun employees, and I'll cover OpenID in the main presentation. And SSO Circle is another site that just popped up, somebody providing identity services in Germany. And there you can do kind of interesting things. They've got OpenID as well. You can do a SAML 2 single sign-on to Google. So what are we doing in OpenSSO? Right now, we're working on a number of things, and it's all out in the open. Every commit goes into the public. CVS, there's no kind of secret enterprise code in the way. We're working a lot on user interface. It's already just a WAR file, so if you work with Java and application servers and so on, it's just a WAR file that you deploy into a container. And then you go to the URL, and the first time around it says, hey, I need to be configured. So we're doing a lot of work to make that configuration as simple and foolproof as possible. So putting in some AJAX stuff so that when you put in the host name and port of the directory server, it actually goes and checks it asynchronously and comes back with a tick or a cross, depending on whether it can get through or not. The whole slew of fields. I'm not going to read the slides out. If you're really excited, I think Andy's going to post them to the site, so that they'll all be there. But we're doing a whole load of work. The real focus in this release is ease of use. So a lot of work on centralizing configuration. The piece of work I've been involved most over the past few weeks has been WS Federation 1.1, so how to integrate back to Microsoft Active Directory Federation services. So to get single sign-on right from the Microsoft desktop, Windows desktop, into a server running OpenSSO and then the resources that it protects. And another area we've focused on is identity services. So if you're a developer, giving the simple web service APIs to do things like authenticate users, authorize them for access to resources, do things like keep an audit trail by logging, get their attributes, all via very simple web service APIs on SOAP or REST. So trying to make it, where there are kind of OASIS and IETF standards that, like 80 pages thick and take about 2 weeks to read and you still don't understand them, trying to get some very basic on-ramp for developers to use where identity is really key to what they're doing. So that's identity services. And so one of the most interesting and exciting places, I don't know if I'm staying more often with the sponsor here. So we've got this thing called OpenID Extensions, where the core product is very tightly controlled. It's the source for some products. We have strict rules on code review and so on. We have this extensions area, which is a bit more kind of Wild West, where we started it with a PHP SAML 2 implementation. Somebody did a port of that to Ruby. Somebody else did some more PHP work. Somebody did an OpenID implementation. And this is kind of an umbrella area where we can take on related projects and say, well, own this part of the CVS and don't worry about checking the code reviews or anything. Just kind of own it and grow it. And then when it gets to a state of maturity, we can look at bringing it into the core. And that's working really well. Got a lot of participation from around the world, Germany, Japan. There's a couple of guys from Japan involved in projects there. So basically, the end of my pitch is participate. This is the most important slide in this particular deck. Go to openSSO.dev.job.net if you're interested in single sign-on. Go sign up. Subscribe to the mailing list. There's an IRC channel where I'm a permanent fixture, so I'm Meta Daddy on the OpenSSO IRC channel. Just get involved. And there's I blog regularly on identity. I'm not going to read out the links. You can get those from the PDF, I'm sure.
Thank you. We've just got a couple of announcements that I would like to make, and I think Crystal Ball has one, and we'll do our have a job, need a job. So the December meeting typically has been sort of mini meeting, social gathering, and that year. That ends up being a couple of easy flag games and maybe some Chinese food or some, you know, some desserts or whatever. And we were kind of talking about it and thinking about what could we do that would be a lot cooler, a lot more fun, you know, and just generally do something that is kind of about our group, but not have to necessarily sit and listen to a presentation, be more of a social thing like we're used to. So we are having, Trilogue is hosting a social networking event. It's going to be held at the DoubleTree in RTP, in a sort of banquet room there. And the reason, part of the reason why it's going to be held there is because it's sponsored by Google. Anyway, we've been working on this for a while, so an announcement will go out. We're going to invite all the user groups. Phil has a list. I can't remember a lot of them, but IEEE, National Society of Black Engineers, who else?
Java.
The Java group. I think even
Perlmongers,
the Ruby Brigade.
There's OS2 users, they're tracking down.
Did you get Trizipug?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Phil has been coordinating our social outreach for this meeting. So
we're going to tag everybody. We're going to hit the computer science departments from all the universities.
We're going to get some computer science students.
Get the trilogue and
T users. And other colleges. And you're all welcome to come out. There will be an announcement very shortly as soon as I get final confirmation on the venue and everything. Google is shipping me boxes of swag, so see you before the meeting. You might get some of that. Okay, Cristobal would like to make an announcement about a struggling organization called IBIBLIO.
Well, we're not struggling. Struggling's a bit strong. Who remembers SunSite at UNC.edu? That's a lot of hands. Look at how many people. So SunSite then turned into MetaLab, eventually iBiblio.org. It has survived 15 years, going strong. I'm a student assistant at UNC with iBiblio.org. iBiblio has gotten great help from IBM, Red Hat, other companies, sponsors. We still need help. If you can give an in-kind donation or tax deductible, we need all sorts of help. We need help financially with bandwidth. We have an ailing mail server that is not under warranty anymore. We could use all sorts of things. So if you or your company can help out iBiblio.org, please come talk to me or send an email to Paul Jones, pjones@metalab.unc.edu. All right, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you, Cristobal. One more announcement before we get to the job segment. The Southeast Tech Show is a technology conference and trade show that I'm planning for November of 08, and we're about to open our call for papers and our RFP, so if anyone is interested in speaking at the tech track or the business track of Southeast Tech Show, I can give you a little bit more information. See me after the meeting. So this is our Have a Job, Need a Job segment. if you are an employer with a job to fill, please come up here and come up to the microphone. Mr. McDowell, come up to the microphone so that everybody can hear you.
Oh,
and
I can speak loudly.
Tell us about your job. And we've got some people remote, so I want to make sure that everyone's here. you can adjust the mic.
Yeah, that's all right. So my name is David McDowell. I work for Copernicus Group IRB. I'm the senior systems administrator there. We have a systems administrator position open. It is primarily a Windows-based shop with Windows clients. We have Linux, VMware, both free and ESX, and we're planning on going with some big sands. We have co-location and servers in our own facility, so it's a growing company. We're going to be hiring 7 more people just in our regular staff before the end of the year. So, you know, this is just one of many IT positions probably in the next couple of years that we'll have open. If you have any questions about it, you can write the HR at cgirb.com or go to the website www.cgirb.com. That's for Copernicus Group IRB.
Thank you.
Zavala. I work for Opsware. And we're looking for some support folks that have significant sysadmin skills. If you go to the website, you can go to opsware.com. Oh, we're HP now. Yeah. But if you go to opsware.com, the website is still up. It will be for probably another month. And then go to the career section, and you'll see a lot more information. But basically, we're looking for significant support that involves significant sysadmin skills, knowledge of protocols, inter-process communication, different OSs, OS provisioning, all sorts of interesting and fun things.
Sure.
I'm Jason Herr. I'm with Raritan. We're looking for a sysadmin that's looking for a position in tech support as well. It's very similar to what the last gentleman was just talking about. We're basically a network management appliance, and we're looking for a tech support person to work on that. We need somebody that knows Linux, Java, and we'd like to learn more about virtualization.
Okay, is there anyone else that has a job they'd like to advertise? Okay, if you are a sysadmin or something that is seeking a job, please come up here. Is there anyone that is looking? I see blank faces, so is anyone looking for a job at all? Well, that's actually good to hear. Okay. So no one's looking for a job. Everyone's gainfully employed. And without further ado, Mr. Pat Patterson.
Okay. So I guess that means that salaries must be rising where there's more jobs than actually candidates. Probably a good thing. Okay, so I'm here today, so the main focus of why I'm here today is to just give you an overview of digital identity, starting at LDAP and moving right on to OAuth, which is almost 1.0 now. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to run through a number of these protocols in kind of roughly chronological order, and for each one, I'm going to give you some background on the protocol, an idea of how it works, and where you would actually use it, and where you might see it. So the idea is that, you know, you're not going to pick up all of these and be an expert in the next 90 minutes, but you should at least have some idea of how they fit together, and at least have an idea of whether to invest the time in reading the spec and picking up the code and, you know, playing with it the next time somebody says, oh, we need this, we need users to log in here and access stuff there, and these are the constraints, and this is where we need it. So I guess about the early 1990s, the dawn of time when I started working for money, identity was in silos. You had a bunch of applications had their own identity repositories, their own tables of users and passwords and what they were allowed to do and so on. And there was this thing called X500 that was standardized by, I think it was CCITT, but it's ITU now, the International Telephone Union or whatever it is. Anyway, big telco-driven organization. And X500, I think the word heavyweight applies here. It was a heavyweight series of protocols running over the OSI stack, which, as we all know, was a raging success, that seven-layer model. But you also had these early NOS, network operating system directories. So the standout there is Nivelle NetWare. Nivelle saw early on that having this concept of a directory service had value. And what I mean by directory service, it's just like a phone directory. It's somewhere you can go and say, where is Pat? I want to search for everybody whose surname begins with Pat. And I want to zero in on this guy, and I want to get his extension and his email address. So that's just what a directory is. And the early 90s also saw, if not the emergence of email, email starting to become ubiquitous. People in companies starting to use email. Companies suddenly needed email directories because it wasn't always obvious that Pat was actually a Pat 1 at example.com. So in the early 90s, this thing called LDAP came up. So LDAP is Lightweight Directory Access Protocol. So it was basically taking X500 and trying to make it usable. And the original guys, Tim Howes at UMich, Steve Kill at ISOD, and Wengyik Yong at Performance Systems International, they took it to IETF. So we have LDAP in the mid-90s. It's an evolution of, based on X500, simplification of X500, trying to make it useful for mere mortals. So the most important letter of LDAP is the P. It's a protocol. It defines what goes on the wire. So this is what really makes it different from a relational database. When people say, oh, why should I use LDAP for my identities? I could just use a relational database. The most important quality it has is that it's a wire protocol. So you don't need drivers. All you need is an LDAP implementation, and you can just start talking. You can authenticate and start getting identities. It's very, very interoperable. So it's a binary protocol. It was designed in the 90s before XML when XML was still SGML. So it's ASM1. It's defined in with BER. Those are, you can go look those up. It's immensely fascinating, ASM1 and BER. But the main thing is it's over TCP/IP. So it runs over the protocol that was emerging at the time that was becoming ubiquitous. So LDAP v3, RFC 2251 was published in 1997. The main guy behind that was Mark Wall, who I was lucky enough to work with at Sun for a while. Incredibly smart guy. A little bit strange, but very, very smart. And it's based, so where a relational database has rows and columns, LDAP is based on a hierarchical model, which maps to the way most companies and organizations actually are. So this is what I've tried to show here. So at the root, DC is the main component. So these, all these things to the left of the equals are attribute names. And so, and each layer is a node in the hierarchy. So we've got some company, example.com, DC is the main component, and OU is organizational unit, so they've got a hierarchy, a subtree that's people, and in there, there's some UID, pat, p. So on that node, there are actual attributes, so CN is common name, email address, object class just tells you what kind of attribute it is. So this is the way that LDAP data is organized. People used to try and map their organizational hierarchy into LDAP and have O equals engineering and O equals marketing and everything. But the problem came that the combination of these nodes, it's called a distinguished name, so that locates you in the directory. And then when you move from marketing to engineering, or probably more likely vice versa, that changes and all hell breaks loose. So people started having a very flat hierarchy with OU equals people, you might have OU equals groups, OU equals machines, OU equals printers to kind of keep things organized. So that's the shape of LDAP. It's a hierarchical database model with a well-defined access protocol. So 10 years ago, people were using it for email address books, pretty basic stuff, corporate white pages, got a little ad that I can type in somebody's name and it comes back with their extension number. Mostly read access. This is the kind of data that, you know, you don't change your office or your extension number or your email address all that often. The reads out number writes by tens or hundreds to one. So we were able to architect the servers and optimize for read access, which gives a number of important optimizations you can do. You know, the writes are just not happening all that often. And they were in the order of, you could support thousands of read requests per second just because of this optimization. And small data sets, for enterprise deployments, 100,000 employees is huge. And of the order of about 20 attributes for a user, that's a lot. If you've just got mailing address, home address maybe, extension number, didn't even have the cell phone really at that time. And very infrequent changes. But now, LDAP is all over the place at a huge scale. It's become a de facto authentication source in the enterprise, in extranet deployments at telcos, because it's somewhere that you can go and authenticate a user very, very quickly. And this is what we're dealing with. As the internet grew and people's customer lists, you know, hopefully grow faster than your employee headcount, that's what you need. You need to be authenticate customers coming into your website. It's the basis for role-based access control. So controlling who has access to what on the basis of their roles, whether they're an HR or an administrator or both. It's a configuration store. You can use it as a hierarchical configuration database just embedded within an application. It's all over the place. It's still in network operating systems. Active Directory supports LDAP. The extranet telco. And the data sets we're seeing, tens of millions is no longer unusual. We have customers in excess of 100 million users, so basically cell phone providers who have directories that span countries so to give roaming service. And the access pattern is actually getting closer to RDBMS now, to a traditional relational database, because you're updating things like last time of access, and things like that, and so the number of reads, the number of writes is actually kind of rising in proportion. So if we look at some basics of working with LDAP, so who's actually done any LDAP, used an API, So Mozilla is really where you start. So they've got the LDAP, C SDK, Java SDK, they've got Perl. If you're more into Java and you want something a bit less performant and more abstract, you can go with JNDI. Or there's the command line. So virtually every, certainly every box with Unix on it will have LDAP search. So this is, I just deployed our OpenDS server and on my machine, so I could do a little playing around. So what I've done here is a LDAP search on localhost on port 1389. I want everything in the subtree from DC.com, where the user ID is PatP. So this is a very common kind of model to use. It. You're searching for a particular user with a particular user ID. And this is what you get back. The distinguished name, so that's like the location of the entry in the hierarchy. A bunch of object classes that tell you what kind of thing it is. So this is this inetorg person is the one that you see all the time because it has all the useful stuff. And you get the mobile number. This is the sample data that OpenDS generates for you. Mail, employee number, all this good stuff. So it's in a very consumable format. You can narrow the, you can add the attributes that you're interested in onto the end. So you, if you really just wanted my email address, you could just put mail on the end and you would just get that line back. So when you're actually using in applications, the common model is that the user comes to the website and logs in. Now, they're not going to give you... See this thing here? This is how you find them in the directory. They're not going to type that in. You're not going to really make them type that in because that's like really horrible. So what they do is you have an ongoing connection to the directory, either anonymous or as an admin user, and the user will type in PatP. So you search for PatP to locate the entry in the directory. If that fails, well, user not found. If that succeeds, then you've got the distinguished name. So then you take the password they gave you and bind as that user. So bind is just authenticate to the directory. And then you're in business. You've authenticated the password. You can get back their attributes. You might get back some profile. You might have preferences for how they see your website, whatever. You can use passwords, the most common one these days. But you could use Kerberos or Client Certs or whatever. There's a protocol called SASL, simple authentication service layer that you can basically pass just about anything into our lab to authenticate your user. So, whoop, wrong corner. Come on. I'm glad we're taping this. So, in terms of products, LDAP is very mature. It's a very mature marketplace. There's a whole bunch of products. Products compete more on the non-functional aspects, the performance, scalability, rather than just features these days. Sun's got its directory server. Also the OpenDS, open source project, which is a directory server implemented in Java from the ground up. Red Hat, our hosts, have their directory server, which has a Fedora variant, and there's also the Open LDAP project, which has been going for some time. So the thing that these products have in common is they all have their roots in the University of Michigan code, in that original code written 15 years ago. And then there's other vendors. There's a Novelli directory, which is, I guess, traced its roots back to NetWare. Active Directory, which is, I don't know, beamed in from Saturn or something. That's another LDAP server. It's not a particularly conformant one, but you can connect to it on 389 and you can authenticate users. And everybody has an LDAP server. So why has LDAP succeeded? You know, why is it just everywhere? Again, the most important thing is it's just a standard protocol. It's not like SQL where you've got a language that's more or less standard and you have to have some kind of driver that matches what's on the other end of the wire. You talk LDAP and the other guy answers the phone. It's got a very flexible model, so that hierarchical database, LDAP defines a whole bunch of object types that are pretty useful. Like iNetwork person is a person who has a bunch of stuff like an email address and a home phone number and a cell phone number. But you can extend it if you want to. The performance, it's all the products have always been architected for performance because you want to be, the emphasis has always been on throughput. You want to be authenticating users as fast as they come to your website. You don't want them to be waiting 5 seconds between pressing OK and having access. And it's pretty simple. You know, a couple of calls and you're authenticating users. But it's not all goodness. There are still issues here. Even if you factor, if you get rid of all of your identity silos and you have one big directory, which never happens anyway, and your users have one username, one password, they're still presenting it a load of times. Every website, even if all your websites are pointing to the same directory, your users are having to kind of give username and password all over the place. And this dream, I guess, probably even just 5 years ago, people dreamt of having a single directory in an enterprise where you would put all of the information. And that just never happened. Partly, it's just not efficient. You want to have some of that information much closer to the applications that are using it, and partly because a lot of enterprises, it's just not legal for them to do that. They can't store use data for even customers from one country in another country, or employees in particular. There are big restrictions on moving data across boundaries. So in reality, LDAP is really, really useful, but it's not a panacea. It doesn't solve world hunger. So these are the problems that enterprises tend to have. I'm going to talk enterprise for a few minutes. Every application wants me to log in. Every website I go to my HR website and I go to the vacation website. They all want me to log in. And I have too many passwords. You know, even with half the applications in the enterprise using the corporate LDAP server, I've still got all these passwords. And, you know, the boss says, well, I don't want to go to jail. We're implementing Sarbanes-Oxley, and I need to control who's got access to what. And nowadays, we're outsourcing our HR, and we've got partners coming in over the wire. So we need to kind of get give access to resources here to people all over. So what happened kind of next after LDAP was this idea of web access management. So people, how many people have heard of Integrity SiteMinder? That was the first big one. Okay, a few. So that was the first big product in this market. So within an enterprise, when people are accessing websites, it's relatively straightforward. You can have a server that authenticates people, issues a cookie, and cookies work nicely within a single internet domain, and start giving people single sign-on across a number of different applications and having control over what they have access to. You can start defining policy to say, okay, only people in these groups can access these pages. So it's a nice bargain that users get the convenience of single sign-on. They can just kind of keep clicking the bookmarks in their browser and just have access. It says, welcome, John. But IT keeps control over what's going on. They can turn on and off access to URLs. So this is the kind of model. You have your hapless user at the bottom here. You've got a number of web servers, application servers, hosting your actual content resources. And then you've got an SSO server where you tell people to go to authenticate. Now, how many people have not seen a swim lane interaction diagram before? Oh, great. Okay, so I'm going to do a little bit. So the way this diagram works is that each of these vertical lines is an actor in the protocol. And as time is the vertical axis, starting at the top and going towards the bottom. So the actors send messages between themselves, and we'll work through how it works. So what's going to happen is that some user with a browser is going to say, I want hrappindex.html. And that's going to get intercepted by an agent deployed into the container. So the idea here is that you either have an agent deployed into Apache or Glassfish or whatever, or you might have a proxy protecting a whole network of servers. But in any case, you need something to mediate access. So the agent says, first time around, well, hey, you have no cookie. Go to the SSO server, just redirect. SSO server and the user authenticate. So this is kind of out of scope. This is the dotted line here. They could use username, password. They might use a smart card. They might use a safe word or RSA token, whatever. Some way of the user proving who they are to the SSO server. And then SSO server issues a cookie. So just in the case of our product, it's just a really long number that's a handle into a table that we keep. So there's no actual content there. It's just a reference into some table inside the SSO server. So this time, the browser comes back around again and says, hey, I want index.html, but this time, I've got the cookie that you need. So the agent says, well, I don't know. SSO server, here's this user represented by a long number. Here's the URL it's trying to access. Tell me what to do. So the SSO server looks in its set of rules, its policy, and says, now, does this user, what roles does this user have? What's the rule for accessing this URL? Is there an intersection here? And it might find that this user has the HR role, and you have to have the HR role to access this URL, so we can allow access. So we say, yes. So the agent is basically just filtering HTTP requests and just allows the request to progress through to the your web server or whatever, and the user gets to see the HR page with his data or whatever. So all of this is we're filtering requests based on who the user is. And again, there's a whole slew of products here. This is, again, is a pretty mature marketplace. They all work in more or less the same way. Sun's got its Access Manager and OpenSSO, which is Access Manager. And Integrity got bought by CA. IBM got Tivoli. Oracle bought Oblix. And Novella are still plugging away with Access Manager. There's also a couple more open source projects. There's CAS, which is quite popular in academia from JAC. and something called JOSO as well. I don't know a huge amount about those, but I know that they exist. Oh, by the way, you can ask questions at any time. It's fine if you've got...
Pat, can you go back?
Yeah.
One more? Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
So the problem that I've generally seen with this is that with all of that crosstalk, performance tends to, suck horribly.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got kind of a natural bottleneck.
Yeah.
Is there anything out there that, you know, somehow replicates that functionality close to the actual application?
So this is a high-level kind of logical view of what's going on. What actually happens is that all this happens when you ask for index.html because the agent's, like, clueless.
Yeah.
What really happens here is that policy for everything that the server knows about, that the SSO server knows about on that web server comes across.
Okay.
So from that point on, the decision is being made here in the agent. So, and there's kind of rules you can set, there's timeouts and so on, because when you change something over here, you'd kind of like it to get reflected here before too long. So
yeah.
You use maybe like a 3-minute timeout before it goes back and says, hey, tell me again what the policy is. Or you can set up notifications so that the SSO server can proactively say, hey, some policy changed, you'll need to re-request. But yeah, what happens in reality, I think, you know, in virtually every product, is you try and minimize the chat by caching at an appropriate place in the network. So usually in the
My experience with NetTegrity was you had two ways of death, which was one, it could load your server up with so much crap that it just fell over on itself, and the other way is it would do so much crosstalk that you would fall asleep while it authenticated you or authorized you for every web page.
Yeah, the integrity used to put a lot of stuff in the cookies, and they used to have to do a lot of encryption and decryption, and it used to work a very different way. I think they would move to lightweight cookies, which are much more like the way that we do it, where it's just an index into a table. And then you can pass, you can have a cache on the agent for a particular user. Because if you've got, the user makes one request, he's going to make another one. Because he's going to get all the images on that page. And, you know, well, hopefully you set the images so that they're protected anyway. So they get passed through at the very first level. But, you know, he's going to be clicking on links and so on.
So I could have the majority of that, you know, maybe after the first call and running on one server without chat. Okay.
Yeah. So it ends up here, and you know this the kind of communication from here to here is kind of minimized. So this has solved a few of the problems we've got. Allowed people, we've given them single sign-on, so they log in once when they arrive, and they might have a session lasting a whole day or a couple of hours or whatever, and they can click on links and go to websites, and they don't have to give their username and password, and they're not querying their monitoring post-its anymore, and you've got control over who has access to what. But all of this just is within a single internet domain, because it's just relying on cookies. You can't pass cookies from Google.com to Yahoo.com. Not that they would ever do that, but you get the point. So so when you're going between enterprises, cookies don't work. And also, you can't start saying, well, we use Sun's product, so you've got to use Sun's product as well. That just doesn't fly very well, especially if you're not the bigger company in the relationship. So what happened was, the idea of identity federation came up. And actually a few things happened at once. Microsoft came out with Passport, which was their idea of giving single sign-on, which is basically we hold everything and you ask us when somebody wants to log in. And people started working at Oasis. A number of companies, including Oracle and Integrity, came together at Oasis to try and standardize something. So what happened was, back in 2002, which is also almost seems like medieval times now, but it's only 5 years ago, OASIS defined SAML 1. So SAML 1 defined a way of representing the fact that the user has logged in and a way of passing that information around. And Liberty, in reaction to Passport, set about saying, well, okay, well, this single sign-on between websites is a great idea, but we don't really want to give everything to Microsoft, so let's define a way that we can all be Microsofts. We can all, anybody can set up an identity provider and, you know, in their own, what they call the circle of trust, be authenticating users and sending them to different places. So the Slipstream release, the inevitable .1 version of the protocol came out, and then kind of all hell broke loose. Liberty took SAML, extended it. So SAML did single sign-on. Liberty wanted to extend it to do things like single logout, to be able to link accounts between one place and another. And then Shibboleth in the academic community decided that they wanted something very similar, but they wanted a bit more privacy and anonymity built into it. So, you know, if you're a student at Duke, you can go to Harvard and say, I want access to that course paper, and all you need to know about me is that I'm a student at Duke. You don't need to know actually who I am. So that was the driver for Shibboleth. And then Microsoft decided that they had to do it their own way, so they came along with WS Federation, which is actually a pretty thin layer on top of SAML when all said and done. And so things are getting a bit chaotic here. We've got essentially four tracks of development, Shibboleth, kind of ongoing work. And then most of the world actually said, well, hang on a minute, a lot of this stuff looks very similar. So Scott Cantor, who's at Ohio State, who's one of the main drivers behind Shibboleth, chaired the SAML 2 effort at OASIS and brought back in Shibboleth and Liberty and the SAML 1 that one spec into SAML 2. So SAML 2 is identity federation for most of the known world. And Liberty said, okay, great, well, SAML 2 is what we need, so that stuff that we defined before, we're moving on. SAML 2 is the way to do single sign-on across domains. Yes, Microsoft decided they didn't want to play and submitted WS Federation to OASIS, so that's kind of trundling through the process. I don't know. I don't want to wear the vendor hat too much. Microsoft claimed that WS Federation does loads of cool stuff that SAML doesn't, but I don't see it. They just want a way for their stuff to work that's different. So,
question.
Yeah.
The SAML stuff has the. Are you familiar with the patent fund with that? Has that been worked out?
Yeah. So there was originally some patent encumbrances. The way it worked was a number of vendors had IPR in SAML. Sun did a patent non-assert covenant, so basically saying, if you're implementing SAML, then we're not going to, you know, if you can infringe on our patents, we don't care. You're licensed to use Sun's patents if you work with SAML. RSA originally had something that said, hey, you have to come to our website and fill out this form, and we will grant you a license, and yada, yada, yada. But even that was too much of an obstacle for a lot of small vendors. They said, well, I haven't got a legal guy that I can have a look at this thing that you wanted me to
put. But it also didn't confer it to anybody you distributed to.
Right.
So your customers would have had to have gone.
So I think it was about a couple of years ago that RSA did the same non-assert that Sun did. So yeah, SAML is now, to my knowledge, SAML's unencumbered.
Okay.
So what is SAML? If you go to the OASIS website, it's pretty intimidating. There's about half a dozen separate PDFs, each of the order of 60 pages. But it's at heart, SAML is assertions. So an assertion is just an XML document that says, I authenticated this user at this point in time by this method, and here's some extra information about it. So it's just that SSO server putting the information that it knows about the user into a standard form. And then with those assertions, you can build protocols. You can build patterns of exchanging them, a request and a response to say, okay, you ask me for one of these, and I'm going to give it to you. But then you need a way to actually bind it to a particular transport. So you say, okay, well, if you send me an HTTP request, you've got to format it in this particular way. The parameters have to be encoded in this particular way, and this is what I'm going to send you in response. And then the profiles wrap all of this up and make it useful. So the downside of all this is that you have four layers of complexity, but the upside is that it makes it tremendously flexible, and that you can start using SAML for, well, you can start using SAML for browser single sign-on, and you can end up using it for web services and having cell phones being able to produce assertions to say, yeah, this is the user, and this is what services is subscribed to. So off to the side, we've got authentication context, which is how the user's authenticated, and metadata, which is how we exchange information between different sites. So the one site, yeah.
So are you saying that if I have my cell phone, you know, with my credentials, per se?
Yeah, So that's the intent with the design of the protocols, and certainly a lot of the stuff in Liberty is that. And so the little side digression here. There's some interesting work in some of the Liberty protocols called PAOS, which is PAOS, which is so backwards. So your cell phone can be a server without being addressable on the network. So what happens is that requests go over the HTTP response, and responses go over the HTTP request. So it ends up that you ask for something, and they say send a request to your cell phone, effectively acting as a server, to say, well, who is this guy? And so the work right now in Liberty on advanced client means that your cell phone can have a certificate that allows it to kind of, it's been granted permission from the great telco in the sky to actually say, hey, yeah, this is Pat, and he's a gold member, and you can accept this, you know, this has got a time limit or whatever. So yeah, I mean, you can't right now, but that's the direction that things are going in, that say a cell phone becomes an identity provider.
So then, like, there'd be like a little Java app or something like that, that in your cell phone you actually like say, you know, like, hi there, I am who I say I am, my little password is rather than an app in the cell phone that'll actually, you know, follow by a computer and send you a log in.
There's a whole stack to implement that, but I mean, and Java on the cell phone is kind of getting there with got JSR 172, 177, they've got the building blocks for all of that to happen. But yeah, in the few other countries that are ahead of the US in its sterling cell phone technology, you can go buy stuff with your cell phone right now. And some of them, it's even like contactless.
And they've had smart cards for years.
Yeah. I mean, I was in Japan, and the Suica card, I'd be on the subway, I could buy stuff from vending machines, and you know, you can build that into a cell phone. But yeah, in general, any device can be creating assertions, because they're just XML, signed XML. So it's a fairly familiar picture now. We've got our user. We've got some service providers, so there's places where the user wants to go to get some pictures or whatever. Yeah.
Sorry, I heard a buzz in there. Signed XML?
Yeah.
Meaning some CA?
Meaning not necessarily a CA. Okay, so it's signed XML with DSIG. A common model is that you have, say, a self-signed route. And in a lot of situations, you've got a fairly limited population. So you can just have point-to-point trust. So that you don't have to go pay for it. I mean, you can, but you don't have to. There's nothing in the model that's signing and smell that says you have to go to VeriSign and get a real cert. You can create a CA cert with OpenSSL. So... So how does it work? So another of these diagrams that you'll come to love. So I go to my service provider. My company has outsourced its HR, which Sun actually has outsourced our HR to Hewitt. The technology works great. When the message gets to Hewitt, that's another question. So what happens is I go to Hewitt and say, okay, I want my HR index page. And so this is quite nice. What happens is that the Hewitt replies with a redirect that has a SAML request encoded into one of the parameters of the location, the target URL. And then that goes to my browser. My browser just goes to where it's been told to go to with that request in the parameter. And I'm at the identity provider now. I'm back at Sun. So I authenticate at Sun if I haven't done so already. And Sun gets to send a response back. So my browser's at Sun. How do I get it back to Hewitt now with potentially, I don't know, 1K, 2K of data? It's not going to fit into a HTTP request. I can't just put it in the parameters. So what I do at the identity provider, I send an HTML form back to the browser with all my XML in the form parameters, but with JavaScript on load to submit the form. So it just bounces off the browser straight back to the service provider. So I can send arbitrary amounts of data from the identity provider to the service provider with this JavaScript on load trick. And now I'm at the service provider. I've got this nice piece of XML I can look at, I can parse, I can decide. Okay, this guy is saying it's Pat, has Pat got a local account or whatever. There's more sophisticated ways of doing it than actually just saying it's Pat. But the service provider gets to make its decision. So this is an important point, is that the responsibility is still with the service provider for what to do. The service provider knows who you are, but he still has to decide, are you allowed to actually access anything? And you get back my page with my HR details. So this is what an assertion looks like. I've kind of taken out a whole bunch of irrelevant stuff, so the signature isn't particularly interesting, but the assertion is signed by its issuer, so the signature is there, and that's actually three times as much as this. But the interesting stuff is that the assertion is about a subject, that's me, and what's happened is that this name ID says who I am, but it says who I am in this kind of long string of garbage. So what's happened is that the first time I go do this single sign-on thing, the two sites agree this opaque persistent identifier that's just a bunch of letters and numbers. Now, the advantage of this is that if I go to another service provider, say as well as our HR, we've outsourced our health benefits, they get a different long string of garbage. And if I go to another one, they get another different one. So this name identifier is for a particular pair. So these service providers can't start colluding and comparing notes and building up a bigger picture of who you are and start marketing one service because they know that you get, you know, you're on this health plan and you earn this much. So this is a really important part of sound, is that built privacy in from the ground up. This thing says it's a bearer token, so whoever presents this is considered to be the subject or acting on the subject's behalf, so you've got to have SSL, you've got to protect it in transit. There's some conditions here. So typically, so this is, assertions have a very short lifetime, so maybe 2 minutes, 3 minutes, an hour, something like that, far shorter than certificates. It's very transient data. It's data that is relevant right now. And the audience is restricted. So this only applies to this site I'm going to. So the scope of the whole thing is narrowed down. Yeah? No. So you could use it. You could pass it with an XML RTPC to represent a user that, you know, to represent a subject that you're acting on behalf of. You could use it in SOAP or whatever, but in itself, it's just an XML element that carries a bunch of information about an authenticated user. But you could certainly, you could use it with XML RPC. You could, the most common use in the enterprise is in SOAP, because we define a way of passing a sample assertion in the SOAP header. And we tell something about when the user authenticated and how the user authenticated. Password protected transport, which means the user presented a username and password over SSL. So the recipient gets a whole bunch of information to say that this is really ZG0OZ, but he can correlate that back in his local database and say, well, yeah, this is Pat. I didn't have to authenticate him or anything, but I know this is Pat. And for a lot of instances like outsourced HR providers, they really would rather not authenticate you. They'd really rather leave that to the company that you work for. So that's why this stuff exists. All the usual suspects have implemented this, with the notable exception. And it's pretty widespread now in terms of being able to work with it. So Internet 2 built OpenSAML, Sun's OpenSSO, there's a whole bunch of other stuff. There's FIDER is the Norwegian Education Federation. They actually built on the Sun PHP to make simple SAML PHP. And Lasso and ZXID, they've got C implementations that you can swig and then use them virtually anywhere. So this is pretty widespread stuff, yeah, Andy.
So if I've got my kind of typical corporate IT thing, I've got a couple Linux servers running websites, I've got some Sun servers from the late 90s, early 2000s, mm-hmm. we haven't gotten rid of yet, my Active Directory, Mobile Vista, yeah. Monstrosities, and probably still a lot of XP boxes.
Mm-hmm.
If Microsoft hasn't signed on to this, is there stuff out there to make it kind of work together?
Excellent question.
So the question was,
this is all well and good, but this is a problem, this except Microsoft thing. They're not playing this game so that every vendor's stuff works except for Microsoft, and oh, there's a lot of Microsoft stuff out there, never mind. So what in effect, you can do a number of things. The thing that OpenSSO does is that it talks to AWS Federation, which is the Microsoft flavor, and you can bridge between protocols. And I've actually got a demo on my laptop that shows this, that you can have OpenSSO in the middle being a service provider as far as Microsoft ADFS is concerned, an identity provider as far as the rest of the world is concerned, and it just shuffles the protocols back and forth. Because you're doing the same thing, you can do this. Sorry, there's a question here that was, yeah.
All those fancy bits of garbage,
yeah.
done per service,
yeah.
provider. How do you do the synchronization of what the service provider's bits of garbage are?
So the identity, so for each user, the service provider will have one bit of garbage against your username, and then the identity provider will have bits of garbage for each service provider. So the correlation has to be with the identity provider. He's got to have an idea that you are ZX3 something or other at service provider 1 and ABC123 at service provider 2 and so on. But the whole idea is that service providers 1 and 2 can't get together.
This is the boring thing about all these different service providers now have to talk to the identity provider and give them their separate bits of garbage.
Yeah.
Involved, out of line.
So that happens if basically the first time you try and do this, you authenticate at both places. So that allows you to tie those together. Or you can do bulk federation where if there's an easy correlation between users at the two different places, you can build those identifiers and exchange them offline.
So there's a part of the protocol?
Yeah. So there's part of the protocol that says, if I land at service provider and he can't find this ID, then he can take you through the regular authentication there or whatever process to figure out which account you correlate to and then write that into the database. So typically what you have is a telco that has wireless and fixed line businesses that have grown up in silos,
And they get to a point and they say, it would be really useful if we knew, you know, if we had a reliable correlation between the users in the two databases, because we really don't know if this guy here is the same as this guy here because he moved house and yada yada. So what they sometimes do, what I think has happened in Europe, is that you get an email from one of those guys that says, hey, you can get 100 free SMS messages if you link your accounts. So go to our website and click here and then click there and then give your fixed line ID and then give your wireless ID and then, you know, we'll be able to serve you better and you get 100 free SMS messages. So that's the kind of way. I mean, if you can do it, if you have a reliable common identifier between the two sides, then that's great because you can just do a bulk job and create, you know, your link name IDs for persistent identifiers. But, you know, that's in the real world, that's very rare. What you do is you get the users to do it for you by incenting them to go and log in at both places and tie things together.
So that is or is not part of the
it is.
Architecture?
So it is. So if you look at, say, SAML 2, there's a whole, so the initial single sign-on could be, yeah. So federation in this sense means the act of linking the two accounts. So it's there in the SAML spec. And either side can actually define the identifier because, you know, it's sometimes random, but sometimes it has a meaning. And there's name identifier management. If for some reason you need to change it, for whatever reason, there's messages you can send back and forth. But the basic thing is the first time you do it, this identifier comes across, and the recipient, if he doesn't know who it is, has to figure it out. And then from that point on, they're linked, and everything just works. So, question over there by the window.
Oh, so it's, all it is a proxy, effectively. The proxy back from like Microsoft Active Directory.
Yeah. So, when I was talking about the thing in the middle with WS Federation on one side and SAML on the other, it's basically, yeah, it's a proxy between two identity protocols. Exactly.
One question from that last slide. And you showed IBM mentioned along with SAML. At one point, I had thought, maybe incorrectly, the case may be, that IBM had kind of thrown their support heavily into the WS Federation camp.
They play both sides.
Okay.
So, they were partners with Microsoft in WS Federation because it's part of the WS Death Star. But they live in the real world and they want to sell systems. And they actually joined Liberty at one point because they made a deal with France Telecom. France Telecom said, we're going to take all this stuff and we need Liberty support, then you've got to step up the plate and go join Liberty. So IBM... They're big enough to play both sides. Yeah.
When you mentioned the form post onload, is that just an example of one way to do it, or is that really the only
way? That's really the canonical way of doing it. it fails if people have got JavaScript turned off, so you really have to send along a button that says click here to continue. I don't know how many people turn JavaScript off these days, but that is the way to do it. You send a form, JavaScript onload, form.submit, whatever it is, and it just happens. It's quite a neat trick. The first time I saw it, I was like, that's how you do it. So I'm going to skip over some of the web services stuff pretty quickly because I'm conscious of the time here, and I guess people want to get on and learn about things like OpenID and OAuth and some of those protocols that are kind of in the news. So basically with it, web services, you've got an end user. You've got what we call in the terminology a web service consumer, but that's just some website that you're visiting. And in order to provide you with the pages that you want to see, it's got to go and make requests to some web service somewhere, a web service provider. So the problem here is that you've got this end user, and his identity is kind of relevant to the services this guy's providing. So if this is a portal, this might be a calendar service, and you want to show the user his appointments for the day. And more important than that, you want to make sure that it's that user you're talking to, because you don't want to show people's private appointments to each other. So the first thing that we think of it as well, just put SSL everywhere, well, that kind of secures things, but doesn't give you a lot of idea of who the actual user is, because there's a number of kind of difficult choices here. With SSL, you can choose between no client authentication or issuing certificates to every client. So issuing certificates to every kind of service is okay, because you've got a small number of them. But issuing certificates to every end user, especially if you don't control those end users, is pretty problematic. So if they're just customers, that's an issue. With transport level security, the scope of the protection is just those individual hops, just those pipes. So there's nothing from one end to the other. And even if you've got client authentication, you've got confidentiality, nobody can snoop, you've got integrity, nobody can insert stuff into the pipe on the way past. But you haven't got much of what we call non-repudiation. It's difficult to take a message and say, well, I did this because you told me to, and here's my proof that you told me to. You'd have to archive the whole SSL conversation, and it's not really practical. It's working at the transport level rather than the message level. So SSL or TLS is still essential. You wouldn't want to do any of this without it, but it's not enough. So we start to get into web services security. So the end user comes to the website. The website goes to some identity provider, gives some credentials. The identity provider comes back with this kind of blob here, which is a token. And then the web service consumer's got a SAML token that represents the user, and he can pass it to the provider. And now the provider knows who Joe is on the left here. So they have a trust relationship. So the web service provider has decided that this identity provider is good enough. So he can send back the calendar appointments, and the portal can render those to the user. So we're kind of getting there, that we still have a number of things that are missing here. We can carry identity tokens in a SOAP header, or alternate transports, you can put them in an HTTP header or whatever. And the industry, even Microsoft, has converged on the SAML assertion as the token, if not the actual protocol for moving them around. And we have all of these nice properties of SAML. We can have bearer tokens, so somebody presents a token to you, that then you assume they're acting for the user. And you can even link tokens to a public key. So if somebody has to send you a signed message, to really believe that they're acting on behalf of that user, and it has to all correlate through the token and the signatures. But you can even archive the tokens along with the message, so you get all of this goodness. But we're still working with single hops along the chain, because you have to restrict the audience of that token to the service you're talking to, because you really don't want to give a token to the calendar service and the calendar service go and use that payroll service. So you have to get, we're kind of getting towards the requirements for web service identity. So we need to identify the end user. Something that's not obvious is that we have to locate the service, because my calendar could be in a different place from somebody else's calendar. My calendar might be in Santa Clara, somebody else's calendar might be in Cary. And we've got to preserve the user's identity all the way down this chain. The calendar server may have to ask some other service for maybe flight details in order to have my calendar up to date. And it's all got to work across domain boundaries and maintain privacy and all of that good stuff. So we get to a point where this is where Liberty went with identity and web services. So we go to the website with our token. And now, this token is good for the website to talk to a discovery service where it can find out where my calendar is. And it gets a different token that it can then present to the calendar, and it's all goodness. And then it starts to scale out, that we can have services calling services, and each interaction is secure and private and restricted to what the users and the services are allowed to do. Because each of these tokens represents some way where you, a control point where you can apply policy, where you can say, well, you know, is the Calendar service really allowed to access the payroll service? Well, no, so I'm not going to issue a token, so you're never going to be able to get there. So we'll zip over this, Liberty. You can go to the Liberty website and read more about it, because I want to get on to the more interesting stuff. WSF 2.0 was the latest iteration of Liberty Web Services. So this is quite interesting. Liberty defined the people service. So, and this is pretty relevant to most people today, is that you've taken some pictures and you've uploaded them to Flickr, and you want your auntie to go and have a look at them, but you send her an invite and she has to go and create a Flickr account, and it's really boring, and half the time she's not going to do it and she never sees the pictures, and you end up printing them out and mailing them to her. So in the last batch of work, Liberty came up with this thing called the People Service. So, you know, Alice wants to share her photos with Bob, and she wants to do it in such a way that Bob just doesn't even need to create an account at her photo service, but everything all hangs together and the security is there and provided. And it's quite an involved protocol. It relies on you having accounts at identity providers, so being in this infrastructure and the people service being there. But that's exactly what it does. Alice gets to go and say, okay, I want something I can send to Bob that's going to let him see my photos, and she can get something that she pastes into an email, or she could give Bob's email address. Because that's the other thing, you've got to share your auntie's email address with Flickr, which you may or may not want to do. So with the people service, it can give you some text that you can paste yourself into an email, send it to the recipient. The recipient can come back, and they can create those links between the accounts so that they can come and see the photos, but without having to create yet another account on Flickr or Zoomer or wherever the heck it is that I've got my photos. So a very good paper written by a very smart guy called Paul Madsen. And yeah, pick the URL out to the PDF. So OpenID. OpenID, a lot of people talking about it. It's getting a lot of press. It's not really single sign-on. They say it's a simple, decentralized authentication system. So the key points here are, what we've been talking about up to now has been very kind of business-focused, very enterprise-focused. You have relationships between often companies or parts of a company. These service providers and identity providers, they know who they each other are. And you know, you've got a list of people that you accept as identity providers, usually just one of them, and you ain't going to accept users from anywhere else. But the idea with OpenID was to have something a bit more free and easy with no prior relationship assumed between OpenID providers, identity providers, and relying parties or service providers. And the thinking from this side was, well, XML is really complex, and can't we just have name value pairs? So that's what they went with. And to solve it, so you've got this idea of a plurality of identity providers, that anybody can be an identity provider, and you could even have one running on your own box. Well, how on earth does your service provider or relying party figure out where it is? Well, you give every user a URL, and that URL tells the relying party in OpenID parlance where to go. So it solves this problem of how do you locate the identity provider? You know, where do you send the user to go authenticate? But in the absence of strong authentication, phishing is a real problem, because now you're giving something to your relying party, where the service provider, where the goodies are, and then it's sending you to your identity provider where your account is, and you're giving something else there. And so you've got your OpenID URL and then your username password. Now, if you just conflated those on a phishing site and asked for your OpenID and your password, how many users are going to say, this is a bit suspicious, this has changed? 99% of them are going to think, great, I can enter this stuff on the same page now. So, I mean, that's in the opinion of a lot of people, including me. OpenID, you have to have something better than username and password, because it's just too vulnerable for that attack of spoofing the credentials out of the user. And to be honest, I'm not sure that your average user in the street will accept the idea of a URL as their identifier. So it's, you know, people are just getting email addresses, and they, you know, maybe they have like Fred or Fred B or whatever is their identifier. I'm not sure how many of the average user population is going to accept http://someprovider/my name. But
you wouldn't actually have to put the HTTP ://
Well, you don't. You could assume that. Yeah, but it's a whole load of dots and slashes. Yeah. So I don't know. I think the jury's still out.
People use email addresses as their sign on now.
So yeah, and OpenID is really over the past couple of years. Brad Fitzpatrick at Six Apart Live Journal came up with the original spec. David Recordon, who went from Six Apart to VeriSign and then back, did a lot of work on 1.1 and is really almost the public face of it, OpenID these days. So OpenID 1.x is authentication plus the simple registration extension, which gives you a way to send some simple attributes, so predefined set of attributes such as nickname, email address, full name, and so on.
So what would you suggest is the chance of its adoption?
I don't know. It's let's see. OpenID. It could be described as the Ron Paul of identity protocols. It makes a lot of noise, and you hear about it a lot. Is it going to win in the end? Maybe. Thank you for feeding me that line. Oh, it's for your benefit. Anyway, so yeah, I mean, it could. I'll kind of get onto that in a slide or two. It could take off. I mean, I could be wrong, and it could just be like reach the tipping point and be huge. I don't think it's the end of the road. I think it's got some very interesting properties in allowing us to locate identity providers, but it's a step along the way. Okay, so OpenID, typically you go to some website that says, what's your OpenID URL? So you type it in, and then a relying party goes to that URL and it looks for some HTML, it looks for a link element that tells it where to go next. And you can have a couple of levels of indirection. So this is the idea of that you're in control of your OpenID. The OpenID can be your blog URL if you've got the ability to actually edit the HTML there and in the HTML header put this link element to point to some server. So the relying party says, okay, well, I know where the identity provider is now. I'm going to associate, which is basically getting a shared secret. So getting some string of data, either just asking for it and getting it back or doing it by a Diffie-Hellman. So it's a protocol for exchanging secret. And then I redirect the browser to say, let's go and authenticate the user. So these protocols, it's getting very familiar now. It's all about figuring out where the identity provider is, sending the user there and having the user authenticate, and then coming back with some response that I can then verify back at the relying party. I've got this shared secret that I got earlier on, and the identity provider signed the message, so I can verify it now and check that it did come from this OpenID provider. It's not been tampered with in transit, and I can send back whatever it is the user asked for. Now, there's some important things here. If we're in a big population where anybody can be an OpenID provider, pretty much all we have by default is the fact that DNS resolved to some server and you did this or associate, and that's what all you have to go on is that it's basically as secure as DNS is, and that's good enough for a lot of stuff, not really good enough for banking and a lot of business, because DNS works great most of the time, but it's not infallible to the point that you could actually depend on it in a secure way. Yeah,
that's not entirely true.
No, there's no traditional PKI certificates. You could do this bit here,
right,
over SSL.
Yeah, just say HTTPS for your.
Yeah,
for
you can do that, but it's not in the core protocol, and the protocol authors resisted it because that implies an overhead for providers. The idea was that anybody could be an OpenID provider, but that means that the actual security inherent in the protocol is pretty much equivalent to DNS. Well, that was the problem they were trying to solve. It was the original, I mean, Brad Fitzpatrick was at LiveJournal, and that, the problem was, I want to leave a comment on somebody's blog, and I don't want to have to create yet another account just to leave a comment. Yeah?
Wouldn't the SAML exchange with the Postback have the same DNS problem?
So there you're signing, you're always signing that SAML assertion. So the SAML processing rules say, if you're sending it back over the post, you have to sign it. There's alternate mechanisms in SAML where you can send back what's called an artifact, which is a short identifier, and then use that artifact to get it directly between the two parties. But anything that goes by the browser in SAML must be signed.
So the idea is that the difference between OpenID and SAML in this flow is that the relying party and the provider already have the shared secret exchange.
Essentially there's what you call the trust route.
Right.
In that, you know, at some point somewhere, you know, theoretically, somebody's turned up with a briefcase locked to their wrist and taken a floppy disk and said, "This is my public key," or whatever, or you get it in the browser. Or so OpenID 2, real soon now. It's been in final draft for quite some time. So changes it brings, it formalizes an extension mechanism. So as well as the simple attributes in SREG, you have ways of conveying more complex messages, keys, generalized attribute exchange, authentication policies, so ways for people to say, okay, well, you've got to authenticate the user with a smart card or a client certificate or whatever. It adds support for something called INAMES, which is a shorter identifier than a URL. So that's like, there's a whole separate set of specifications called XRI that you can read about INAMES, but essentially it's another registry for you to register an identifier and have a global identifier space. And
so does it get rid of the man in the middle kind of flaw in the further you spec or not?
Not really. Because it's still, the idea is that anybody could be an OpenID provider. I mean, if you want to get around it, you can do SSL, but it's not mandated in. You know, it's if you follow the SAML rules, it's secure. But OpenID gives you a path through the spec that you can deploy it, and it's no more secure than DNS.
And the objection is there's a little bit too much compute time on the server side with the encryption.
Well, it's another barrier to adoption. You have to you have to have some certificate infrastructure. You've either got to use public CA, you know, certs and buy a cert, or you've got to actually exchange routes and deal with that.
I don't think turning on SSL solves it, because if you give an SSL URL, it could still be, you're still relying on DNS, right?
You're relying on DNS plus the fact that there's correspondence between the DNS and the cert and the DNS you're talking to.
So they'd have to have
a cert issued in. So attacker with a random IP address would have to have a cert issued in identityprovider.com's domain, which theoretically should not happen. So don't get me wrong. I'm not rubbishing OpenID at all. What I think is that it's almost like a pyramid, where at the base of the pyramid you've got a lot of applications that you don't actually need much security for. Really, you only need to know that this is the same guy as last time, and have a pretty good idea of that. So, you know, there are a lot of sites like blog comments and, you know, leaving comments on pictures of Flickr and all that, that nobody loses a lot of money if it's broken. But then higher up the pyramid, there are many fewer sites that need much stronger security. So there's space for... So this is the point of like going through these protocols. The space for these different protocols, and you'd want to use them at different times. And so OpenID is probably not something that you'd use for secure home banking. So this was just, so XRDS is actually quite nice because instead of having a link element in some HTML, you actually have now an XML document that you can say, okay, well, here's my OpenID service, here's my SAML service, and here's a page that if you go to this URL with just an ordinary browser, you'll get a contact page that you can send me some email or send me a message. So OpenID is seeing some adoption, but curiously, it's on the identity provider side. The identity providers, VeriSign has got PIP, AOL, if you've got an AOL screen name, you've got an OpenID. So I think it's openid.aol.com. If you put that in front of your screen name, you have an OpenID. France Telecom, Orange, recently rolled out an OpenID service, and Sun put an OpenID provider online to give every Sun employee an OpenID as a way of learning about how this can be used in the enterprise. But the interesting thing is on the relying party side, Doppler is probably the highest profile. I don't know, Doppler, Zoomer, Magnolia, a lot of Web 2.0 companies, but no real marquee names in there. The traction, I don't know, it doesn't seem to be happening on the relying party side. And that might be because the relying party is where the resources are. That's where the stuff that you're trying to protect is. And they maybe need a bit more persuading that OpenID is useful for them. A lot of applications building them in now. Content management systems, Drupal, Plone, etc., WordPress. There's a lot of libraries. It's in OpenSSO now. One of our external contributors built OpenID. Who knows? It could be the next big thing, or it could be just a step on the way to a great future. Yeah. And so that brings us to card space. Also known as InfoCard, released by Microsoft end of last year, beginning of this. Now, card space is actually very interesting because everything so far has in common that you're working with a standard browser. You're limited to this model of render some HTML and get the user to do something and send him somewhere and maybe send a form post back, and it's all kind of like driving with oven gloves on. It's all, you're kind of a bit removed from what's really going on. So the card space idea, and really, you know, for good or bad, only Microsoft can do this, is to actually have a smart client. So something on the desktop that is smarter than a browser that can have an idea of identity, that can hold keys and have a bit more sophisticated user interface to get away from this idea of passing everything via web pages. So if you think of OpenID as going like one particular track with moving away from XML in favor of simplicity and name value pairs, CardSpace is way over on the other side. It's XML, it's based on the WSStar stack, these composable protocols that you need four of them at least to get any useful work done, particularly WS Trust, protocol for exchanging tokens. So an interesting thing about this is that Microsoft are positively encouraging third-party implementations. They want this stuff to be out there. They want identity selectors on platforms other than Windows. They want people to be able to issue identities and accept identities. So we've seen a huge range of third-party implementations. Identity selectors, there's an industry group called Higgins that are building identity selectors in Eclipse for the Mac and web-based, so your identity selector can actually be a website rather than the smart client if if you want to have that mobility. There's a project by a very smart guy called Chuck Mortimer called XMLDAP, who he's basically done all of CardSpace in Java. And there's a whole host of identity providers. OpenSSO, we recently did some interop testing with CardSpace. And a whole host of relying parties. So all of the points in the CardSpace protocol, you can do the whole thing without Microsoft at all, even though it's a Microsoft-driven initiative. So it's based around this concept of an information card, an info card, something you have, something that's tangible for the average end user, something that looks a bit like a credit card, when they see it in the UI. So we get one of those from our bank or from Microsoft or whatever by clicking on a link. They maybe send you an email or whatever. So the user goes to get some page. Now the relying party sends back some bit of HTML that has some magic in that says to Internet Explorer, hey, start up the identity selector. And so the identity selector says, okay, relying party, what do you need? Because I might have half a dozen cards here from Home Depot loyalty card and a bank card and what have you. Give me something to go on here. Let me give the user some choices. So you get back this security policy that says, okay, I need a card that, from this issuer or whatever. And the identity selector looks at the policy, looks at what cards you've got, and gives you a set of cards to choose. So you say, hey, I want this one. It's my bank. So, and it does this every time, by the way. If you've got one matching card, it'll pop up and say, hey, you've got to select a card, and this is the only one you can select. Because they've got this idea of consistent, what they call a consistent ceremony, having a very consistent user interface. And so the identity selector says to the identifier, okay, well, how do I send you this card? And it says, well, you can send it to me via 128-bit encrypted SSL, and these are the CAs that I like. And so the identity selector says, okay, backing up a little bit. This is for managed cards where the card you actually have in UI tells you how to go get the real card. So you go get the real card, you say, okay, well, here's my username and password, give me the real card, and this security token comes back, which is actually a SAML assertion. This is not simple, by the way. And then you pass that to the relying party, and the relying party says, hey, yeah, you're good to go. So this is actually works pretty well. Again, in my opinion, it's a 1.0 technology that is not, card space in its current incarnation is not the destination, but it's another interesting way of providing some really useful capabilities. And the idea of having an identity selector, something that lives on the user's machine that has some credentials that they can kind of make it a little bit more concrete for the user, they've got this familiar looking card that they click on, is a good one. But again, I had a look just the other day, and the two places, and there are more than two, there are other kind of minor people who have enabled it on their blog, but the two biggest places you can use a card space are Kim Cameron's blog. He's the Microsoft architect that's basically behind card space, and Microsoft Windows Live ID. So again, it's quite similar to OpenID. That all the mechanics are there, and you've got this great system being delivered with Vista and IE7, but just doesn't seem to be many places to use it. And that's where you get into the chicken and egg of these systems, is that if there's nowhere much to use it, people don't bother getting one, and if nobody much has got one, then nobody bothers enabling it.
I guess to me, a lot of this seems to focus on, public internet sites, and public internet sites try and explain something other than user and password to, Joe,
right.
User, and he's like, I'll go to another site where I can just
use my. That's exactly the experience. Yeah.
But on the enterprise side,
you're
trying to tell somebody, that they're going to do something more different or other than log into their Windows box with their username and password. I don't know that that's a complete not non-starter either. So you got to log into the Windows box anyway.
Right.
Well, I don't. You got to log in the Windows box anyway. Now all the sites on the intranet and possibly partner sites, whatever, should just work. Right?
Yeah, and that's what you're aiming for, is that. Once you've got your login to Windows, you can leverage that credential to go to wherever, because you're logged into Windows. Windows is able through ADFS to say, hey, yeah, this is Andy. I can represent that all over. But they're very different spaces. The enterprise to a certain extent, as an enterprise IT department, you can mandate how it's going to work. But anyway, it actually works out in practice or not, not is another matter, but you have some control over your user population. On the internet, you're just at the mercy of what people will actually adopt. And where websites have said, we're going to mandate OpenID login, this is going to be the only way you can access this website, they've seen their user registrations just dive off a cliff and they've had to turn on the username password. So I think what's, and this is not, this is stuff I'm repeating that I've read, but somebody did basically say that, well, when I go to a website and it says, hey, we accept OpenID, or you can do username password, I could spend half an hour to go and read about OpenID and decide which identity provider I'm going to use and create an account there and think of a really good password because I'm going to be using this ID everywhere and figure all this out, and that's going to take you about half an hour, or I could take 30 seconds to just put in the password I always use on everything apart from my bank website and my initials, and it's just going to work. And people, 30 seconds against 30 minutes, and they're always going to choose the 30 seconds and never going to think, well, this I can amortize this over 60 visits to different websites. Yeah.
Is anybody talking about doing anything with a smart card or even a compact flash card or something?
Yeah.
Does everybody have the CFC?
So in all these diagrams where I've got that dotted line that says authenticate, that's exactly what that is. So you can do that authenticate with username password or a smart card or a hardware token, one of those one-time password tokens. But you're always authenticating back to your identity provider. So the trick is how you then represent that event to everywhere else in the network. But yeah, I mean, that's if anything, will save OpenID. I think that will be it, that you've got an identity provider that... Because all of those mechanisms cost money. And if an identity provider can provide that service and n different relying parties get to leverage it, well, that might fly. So we're into the home stretch now. So OAuth is the last one. I mean, the ink isn't even dry on OAuth. It's not quite reached version 1.0. OAuth is really interesting in that it focuses on authorization rather than authentication. Authentication is, who are you? Authorization is, are you allowed to do this? And it turns out that quite often authentication is just a step towards getting that authorization. You don't really need to know who people are. So up until OAuth, each major internet property had its own way of doing exactly the same thing. So the use case is that I've got some data or some services I'm providing as Google or Yahoo or whoever, and third parties want to access those, and they want to be able to send you to Google to authenticate and ask your permission and say, is it okay to share your the details of who you are or access this service to this third-party site? But everybody had the same problem at about the same time, and everybody did it their own way. So Yahoo, Google, AOL, Flickr, there's plenty of others. And somewhere along the line, somebody said, enough, I'm not going to do this anymore. And Twitter, some of the guys from Google, Pounce, Flickr, a bunch of other sites got together and said, well, we all have the same problem. Let's just solve it the same way. We need to authorize third-party services to access me. So a really good example is Twitter. How many people have used Twitter? Okay, quite a few. So Twitter, you just send short status messages. But there's lots of cool little mashups with Twitter. There's lots of cool little ways that you can post messages from different devices, from different websites. There's a site called Pocket Tweets, I think, says it from my iPhone. What they all have in common is they all kind of link into Twitter, and they all require you to give them your Twitter username and password. And this is not a good thing, because you go see some cool functionality, and the first thing it says to use this, enter your Twitter username and password. And you think, well, hey, it's only Twitter. But it's not a good thing to be sharing this around. And so this is exactly the use case. You need a way for third-party service, instead of saying, give me your Twitter username and password, send you to Twitter, get a token back, and then access services on your behalf. So again, the OAuth guys took a different tack from say, Liberty with IDWSF, which is very heavily enterprise web service focused. The OAuth guys said, well, we've got these services out there. It's kind of the Wild West. They're using PHP 3 even, and we need this to be able to work. So it's all at the HTTP level. It's all HTTP headers, GET parameters, posts. There isn't a hint of XML there. And we request some service, the consumer. So unfortunately, one of the bad things here is that people have different terminology. So you've got the user is the user, almost always. The consumer here is cool web service. And service provider is Twitter or Google or whoever. So you get some token back, you redirect the user to the service provider. The user says, yep, here's my Google login, I am me. And the Google says, hey, cool site wants to access your information. Cool site wants to access your address book. That's a really common one now. That you want to leverage your Google contacts into some social network. Right now, most of them, you have to just give them your Google login. So you do this redirect dance, you get a token back from the, you request an access token, you send a token back, you request the resource, and that might just be HTTP GET on some photo, and you get the thing you first asked for. So I think I've got one or two more slides. So it's early days for OAuth. They're just getting the wrinkles out of 1.0. OAuth's been defined in a Google email group, so you can just go sign up and participate. There's test endpoints online at Twitter and Magnolia, and the fact that Google had a couple of senior engineers working on this kind of leads you to believe that they have an interest in working with us. So the very last slide. So there's something called Concordia. So if you're actually using this stuff and trying to get it working, and it's like, I was going to say something else, but there's under 18s present. Oh my goodness, there's like five different ways of doing this, and how does it all work together? There's this thing called Concordia. It's not a protocol, it's not even really an organization, it's just a banner under which people meet at Burton Catalyst Conference, Internet Identity Workshop, various venues, and basically customers get together with implementers.
Some great vendors, boozers.
It has been known. And people like Boeing show up and say, we've got all of our, we've selected SAML as our strategic choice for single sign-on, but our users are all using Windows. How do we get it all working together? So Concordia is the forum for that. And with that, I'm just about to go on.
Yeah.
Thanks, Pat. Just a couple of final announcements I want to put out. Again, December 13th is our December meeting, networking, social, and we'll put out an announcement from Phil or myself about the specific details of that meeting, which will more than likely be at the DoubleTree in RTP. Greg Koenigsberg, our host here, every month Red Hat, of course, hosts us, and we thank them, as always, for the venue. He would like me to announce that starting November 12th, you can buy a one laptop per child, XO, and donate one at the same time at xogiving.org. So if you're interested, go to xogiving.org. They actually have a place where you can put in your email address, and they'll send you a reminder. So if you're so inclined, please do purchase and donate a laptop. With that, thanks for coming, and we'll see you next month.